Okay. Welcome, everybody. This is the seventh lecture, just one more to go in our final course on Murray Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. This is November 2011, the first time we've taught this course. And today we are going through the second third of Chapter 12, the chapter on interventionism. So as you can see, if you're looking at the slides, we've got a lot of topics to go through. For example, just one of the sections is on socialism, so that's showing you this is going to be a lot of material. Okay, where this delineation starts off, the section is on transfer payments. So here, Rothbard makes a number of observations. He points out that, as usual, when it comes to the government, Rothbard says there's an important distinction to be made between people who are on net paying the taxes and those who are receiving them, and so that what happens when you have transfer payments, which differ from when the government spends money directly, or at least there's a conceptual difference there between the government, say, building a bridge or building a bomb or building a monument to Abraham Lincoln with tax dollars versus giving welfare payments or giving retirement funds or something like that to other recipients. So it does get interesting when you really try to drill down to, well, what's the actual difference between those two different categories, which at first, you know, it seems like there's a huge qualitative difference between the two things, between government expenditure per se versus like a mere transfer payment, like government consumption of goods or services, or what you might call government investment. And in the Keynesian statistics, they do make a sharp distinction between those two things, between transfer payments and government purchases. But you know, from a praxeological point of view, actually it gets a little bit murky, because ultimately the government officials are spending money to achieve their own ends, and whether the end is to build a bridge so that the constituents in that area vote for you in the next election, or whether it's to hand out money to people so they vote for you, or whatever, to, you know, funnel a nice contract to some defense firm so that you, when you retire, they can have you as a consultant and give you $300,000 salary for the rest of your life. I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can explain what government officials are doing when they're in power. And like I say, from that perspective, it's actually not clear that there is, should be this categorical difference between government purchases versus transfer payments. But regardless, if you do want to look at it as a form of a transfer payment, if you do want to focus on it, still you've got the point that Rothbard makes. When you are taxing one group and subsidizing a different group, we'll look at the incentives that sets up. That sets in motion a tendency for people to shrink the tax base, and then also to expand the target group that receives the subsidies. So for an extreme case, if the government levies a 95% income tax on all brackets in order to give a $40,000 annual stipend to anyone who's not working, you can see why that would break down pretty quickly, because after a year of that, very few people would work and everybody would be unemployed trying to get on that handout list, right? So that's you know, an exaggeration, but you see the point there that Rothbard's trying to make. I should mention throughout this section, Rothbard says some stuff that it's, how can I put it? He can get away with having said it in whenever he wrote the book came out in 1962, but he was clearly working on it for a while before then, where you can see how someone writing back then could say some of these things, whereas now it would be pretty politically incorrect to say that. So, for example, when I talk about privatizing school, I'm probably not going to say, yeah, I mean, if some parents went to segregated schools and other ones don't, then they're free to do that in the free market. You know, probably not a point I'm going to stress to the general public anymore, whereas Rothbard does say that. But, I mean, in fairness, there, it's not that Rothbard was like sticking up for people who want segregation. What he was trying to show there is that the private sector defuses conflict, whereas if you try to run stuff through government, it fuels antagonism. It makes people more bitter and causes groups to draw lines in the sand to look at the other groups as enemies. That the nature of government exacerbates those underlying social tensions. So it actually is a very important point that if you are in a society where certain racial groups don't get along, you're not helping things by having the government come in and basically pick one side as the winner and then force the other side to submit, that you're actually going to, you know, cause a lot of conflict. And so here, now I'm just speaking, this isn't in Rothbard's thing. The obvious objection to that people will say is, oh yeah, well that's what the defenders of segregation were saying back in the 60s, but, you know, the government went ahead and forced segregation on the schools, and nowadays we all laugh at that, and, well, not laugh, but we all are stunned that it ever could have been true in the United States, you know, just a few decades ago, that this was even an issue, that people with a straight face in public would get up and oppose having, you know, blacks and whites go to the same school. Can you even imagine? Such has been our, you know, enlightenment on racial issues, and that's because, fortunately enough, good people had the government use force to get this, you know, socially desirable outcome. So, again, but that's like what's the seen and the unseen. All right? We don't know how things would have evolved. I mean, there were a lot of people that were really angry about segregation, about forced desegregation, or integration would be the term. For foreign viewers, let me just make sure you understand. So in the 1960s, there was a lot of strife in the United States, a lot of conflict, and one of the big issues was, especially in the South, so the South, that's where there had been plantation slavery before this, what we call the Civil War, the war between the states. And so, generally speaking, people tended to be more racist in the South than in the North. I mean, obviously, that's a broad statement. There are exceptions, but, you know, that's kind of how things were. So it was more socially acceptable for white people in the southern states, southern part of the United States, to publicly say we want policies to keep the races separate. So they had things like drinking fountains where only white people would use, or public restrooms where, you know, they were designated by color. Okay, and then so it was a drive through government policies to like get rid of that stuff and to override the wishes of, in some places, majorities at lower jurisdictional levels. All right, and so there were things like that, like black students who would go to schools that historically had been just for whites, because a higher level of the government ordered that school had to let those kids in. And so there was a lot of anger and tension and resentment among people who wanted to keep things the way they were. So what I'm saying is, we don't know if that stuff had all been privatized, what the world would look like right now, right? So because the advocates of government-forced integration were just assuming that in a free market, all those racists would get their way and we would have had segregated schools forever, but that's actually not what would have happened necessarily, because remember, it was local government-supported schools that had these policies, and like the things with Rosa Parks, you know, and riding the buses, a lot of those laws were government policies at the local level. And so if you had it thrown open to a genuine free market where, yeah, it was legal, and if you wanted to run a school, you know, a for-profit school or one that was supported by voluntary donations, you could have whatever policies you wanted, and it would be legal if you said only whites are here. But the point is, could such a school have stayed in business for 40 years, given that you would think one by one the other segregated schools would convert as market forces operated on them? And so I don't think that that's the case. So it may be true that if you had schools remain under the power of local governments and state governments, and the federal government didn't come in and overrule them, that maybe segregation would have persisted. But that's not what Rofford's arguing for here. Rofford is clearly being consistent and saying, yeah, I don't want the federal government telling kids where they can and can't go to school, but I also don't want state and local governments doing it either. Turn it all over to genuine private property in a free market. And Rofford, I don't think, does it so much in this part of the book, but he subscribes to the general free market tradition in terms of how market forces actually break down segregation, because it makes it costly to engage in racial and other forms of discrimination that have no basis in reality. Like if you have two, I'm sort of going off on a tangent here, but let me just finish this train of thought since I brought up this sensitive topic. Let me at least cover myself and make sure you guys get what the free market position is on this. That, you know, you have an employer who's got two applicants for a job. There's only one job opening. And, you know, one employee is white and the other one's black, let's say, and the employer's a racist. So let's say that actually the black employee is more productive than the white one. And yet the employer looks so that the black employee would, you know, deliver $10,000 more to the bottom line than the white guy would. But the employer is a racist, and so he hires the white guy because he thinks, oh, if I hire that black guy, he's going to steal from me or something, even though the guy wouldn't. It's just the employer, you know, has a false stereotype. Well, in a totally free market, he would have the legal right to do that. There wouldn't, you know, there wouldn't be any sort of government agency that would come in and look at his books and see what are the racial characteristics of your workforce compared to the people you that applied for the job and that kind of thing. But he instantly got fined by the way we constructed that problem or that situation. Because he picked a candidate that wasn't the best qualified, he's now $10,000 poorer. So in a very real sense, the sense that we use in economics all the time, in other contexts, his racism or his discrimination, more technically, cost him $10,000. And the beauty of it is the more absurd and ridiculous and unfair his discrimination is, the costlier it is. So if it's the kind of thing where you had two applicants and they were almost the same and the minority was a little bit better and the guy, because of his prejudice, picks, you know, the person that, you know, goes to his church or looks like him or whatever, then it's not that costly, but at the same time, it wasn't that big of an injustice. Whereas if it's, you know, all sorts of people in the community just aren't going to hire Jewish people, let's say, because they don't trust them. Well, I mean, if these are very productive people, that's a huge economic loss that all the potential employers are suffering there because of their discriminatory policies. So, you know, it's again, you have the freedom to do it, just like if a business person wanted to, he could make cars that were purple and had three wheels and a door that you had to climb over the back seat to get out of the car. I mean, you have the legal right to do that under free market capitalism, but there would be serious financial penalties for doing that, and if you kept doing it, pretty soon you would go out of business to be replaced by somebody else who was catering to the consumer better. So it's the same thing here. Yeah, under pure laissez-faire capitalism, an employer has the right to hire people based on characteristics that we think are irrelevant or even immoral, you know, considerations that we think shouldn't play a part. But if it really is true that he's deviating from marginal productivity in his hiring decisions, well, then that's, you know, he's paying the price. And he can do it a little bit, maybe. It's still making him pay for it. And so he's poorer than he otherwise would be. But if he does it really outrageously, eventually he's going to go out of business and be replaced by somebody who's not as racist. All right, so that's the type of arguments people would make. So with schools, to come back to the topic that started this, I mean, in the private sector, schools have to pass the market test, even if they rely on donations from alumni and from other people who, you know, like what the school stands for, still, they have to get enough funding from people who voluntarily give it in order to pay their monetary expenses. And so if you if you're embedded in a society that has a bunch of racists, it's possible that they will support a few schools like that. But you would think, especially if you're also adjacent to regions that have people who aren't racist or where racists aren't as prevalent, that over time, you know, the advantages of not engaging in unfair discrimination will work their superiority, demonstrate their superiority, and those schools will outcompete the other ones, right? So just to give you an example, an employer who's hiring from either school and where the employer is not racist is going to find that the school that doesn't care about skin color tends to send better applicants or graduates, I should say, other things equal, right? Because, you know, that when they look at the people applying to go to their school, they just look at their grades and, you know, their extracurricular activities, and they don't also say, oh, and by the way, you can't be black. So one way of looking at it is the racist schools would be turning away very gifted students or people that would be really good on the football team or whatever based on their skin color, and so they would be at a disadvantage compared to a school that didn't use such an arbitrary characteristic. And so the other school would do better, you know, in the sporting field, but also in terms of the GPA of their students and then how the student's success when they go on to try to get a job after they graduate. So whatever the sense in which a school is a business would also suffer if they used completely arbitrary criteria like what your religious view was or what your race was or whatever. So that's just want to make sure you get that even somebody. But my point is, Rofford says some stuff here without being very sensitive and just blows right through it, which for something that came out in 1962, I think, or 61, I forget when this thing was published, you know, it's more understandable. Whereas now I read it, it's kind of like, whoa, you know, that's, we might want to sand that down a little bit, soften it up, because nowadays that sounds a little bit politically incorrect. But anyway, that's the context there. What sparked me into saying that was this quote here that Thomas McKay did from 1896, which says, "We can have exactly as many paupers as the country chooses to pay for." So again, you know, if I were on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, I probably wouldn't use that quote to try to ingratiate myself with the crowd, even though I understand the sentiment. So the sentiment there, they're saying that in a free market, anybody with some skills, I mean, obviously if there's somebody who truly has zero productivity, he's not going to be able to get hired. But people who have some productivity in a free market will be able to get hired, perhaps at a very low wage. And so unemployment in that respect is voluntary. So it's no fun if there's a person who really wants to be able to work for $8 an hour, but people are only willing to pay him $6. He might not have a job because he's saying, no, I'm holding out, waiting for someone to give me $8 an hour, and I'm going to keep looking until I find it. So that person is unemployed, and he might think it's because the world is unfair and these employers are a bunch of idiots, or, you know, there's institutional forces that are acting against him or whatever. But if it's a genuine free market, there aren't minimum wage laws, things like that, Rothbard is going to say, well, no, that's, you're choosing to remain unemployed. You could go work at this place for $6 an hour and you don't want to. So don't blame your unemployment on anybody else but yourself. And so if you ask, okay, but well, then why do we have persistent long-term unemployment? Well, one of the reasons is the government quite often will send checks to people. And so, you know, back a long time ago, they might have called it, you know, support for paupers or poor relief, things like that, whereas nowadays we tend, you know, we might call it unemployment benefits or welfare payments. You know, there's all sorts of different programs. But the point is, proponents of those things think that they are alleviating the conditions of the people whom capitalism is just, you know, leaving behind. Yeah, the market economy is good and it's more efficient than socialism, but there are some people that fall through the cracks, and we don't want to let them just starve because they can't get a job. And so the government should send them money so they can go buy food and, you know, that kind of stuff. Give them vouchers for child care, all that kind of stuff. So the point here is you're in effect subsidizing that. You're making it easier to be in that condition. You're taking away the incentives on the margin for people to lower their standards and take a job that pays less than they think they're worth. And so it, you know, don't be shocked then that if you increase those benefits that you get more of the social condition that you think you're trying to eliminate. So in all that, you know, like I say, just to, with all this stuff, if it doesn't seem like it's true in the actual amounts that are being practiced in the real world, exaggerate the numbers just to see the principle that if the government offered a $50,000 annual stipend to anyone who could show that he didn't have a job, the unemployment rate would get pretty high. And that's actually a lot of economists are saying that right now in the United States, the reason, part of the reason that unemployment is so persistent. So there's a difference between right now what's the unemployment rate or what's the number of people who are unemployed versus saying, look at the population of unemployed people right now and how long have they been unemployed? Because that's another thing that about this current recession that's pretty unusual is the average duration of unemployment spells is incredibly high for this recession. So meaning it's not just that the percentage of people in the workforce who can't find a job right now is higher than, you know, historical average and is pretty bad in terms of a recession, but that if you go and look at the people that actually are unemployed and you say, how long has it been since you've been had a job, and then you look at the answers that every unemployed person gives you and you calculate the mean, that number right now is way higher than it normally is even during a recession. And so to try to understand that, economists are saying one of the reasons is Congress this time around has kept extending unemployment benefits. I think right now they were like at 99 weeks. All right, so you can be unemployed in the United States up to 99 weeks, which is more than 2 years. Well, no, not more than 2 years, duh. It's what's that, 104 weeks would be 2 years. So almost 2 years, and still be getting checks from the government. So in terms of somebody, you know, had a great job in construction during the housing boom, the bubble collapsed, and now is getting checks from the government looking for another job. If that person had been making, I don't know what they made, $60,000 a year, and now because the housing is totally destroyed for a while, his next best thing is to go wait tables at a diner and make $25,000 a year, I have no idea what those numbers would be, then you can see that's a huge pay cut. And so rather than going and working in a dirty diner and, you know, having customers swear at you and having to set your alarm every day and get $25,000 a year, maybe the person gets, you know, doesn't make as much from the government but can sleep in and just hang out with his friends and play video games, right? Go to the public library and surf the internet all day. And, you know, apply for job openings, but not really as hard as he would if he weren't getting checks from the government for 99 weeks. So that's the argument. Having said that, let me just say something briefly. Lately, it seems to me there's something a little bit off in that argument. And it's not that I think that it's wrong, but the way we normally talk, and by we, I mean like laissez-faire economists. Now, I'm not just talking about Austrians here. But a lot of free market, laissez-faire kind of guys and gals, we bring up the unemployment benefits when people are saying, why is unemployment so high? So I, as an Austrian, of course, think the reason we had the boom and the bust was because of the Fed. But then a separate question is, why is this recession lasting so long? I mean, the boom popped, you know, the housing bubble popped in 06 or 07 at the latest. And so we're now going into 5 years after that, why is it taking so long for resources to get reallocated? And so there, one of the reasons I think is because of these generous unemployment benefits that keep getting extended. So I think, you know, a lot of people agree with that, a lot of free market people. But what's interesting, and this is what I've been thinking about lately, is why it sounds like what we're saying is we all agree unemployment is a terrible social problem, and the way to get unemployment to go down is to stop sending checks to these people. But actually, from their own narrow point of view, that would make those people worse off, right? Because on our own argument, they could go work for some, you know, some job at a pay rate that they think is unacceptable to them. They'd rather just enjoy their leisure. And so if we stop sending them checks, they'd say, oh, all right, I'll go take that job down at the diner. And so the unemployment rate would go down, but those people are worse off from their own perspective, because we know they would rather have gotten the checks from the government and not taken that job, but we kind of forced their hand by cutting off the checks. So it's a little bit weird. It sounds like we're being compassionate, not being compassionate, but it sounds like we're saying, if you really want to help these unemployed people, stop extending unemployment benefits. But actually, that's not what we're saying. We're saying, if you want to hurt these unemployed people and make them worse off by their own light, but you, as an economist or an analyst, hate seeing that really high number on the unemployment rate, then you should support cutting off these benefits and hurting the unemployed, but lowering that statistical figure that gives you discomfort. Right? So, I mean, I'm exaggerating, but that's what's been troubling me lately. That something's not quite right, and I'm trying to put my finger on what it is. That, you know, you want to say the way to help the unemployed is to help them get a job, and the thing that's preventing the recovery in part is the unemployment benefits, but that seems kind of weird. It's almost like I'm worried that we sound like people who are against the Chinese subsidizing imports to the United States. And that, you know, as free market economists, we usually say, well, no, that's, let them do that. If they want to give us cheap products, so be it. And by the same token here, you can imagine the unemployed person saying, well, yeah, I can't control what the government does. They're hurting the taxpayer, that's sure, by sending me these checks. But while the checks are coming in, if on the margin I'd rather get the check and be unemployed than vice versa, well, then enjoy it while it lasts. That's the tension I'm seeing here, and I'm trying to figure out what the difference is. Okay, but maybe I should return to talking about Rothbard instead of going off on tangents. Okay, so the next section here, I wasn't sure what to call this, because Rothbard was talking about free government services, and you know, he's putting free in quotation marks. But really, for a lot of this stuff, it's not that it's free, it's that it's underpriced. So it's priced below what the market price would be to the end user. Of course, it's actually more expensive when you consider how much the taxpayer has to pay for it. But the point is, the actual end consumer, the price that's being charged to him to use it is lower than what the market price would be at that point. So some examples, so the way this slide works is I have on the left examples of the government, so like water provision or a subway in a major city. And then on the right, I'm trying to show stuff that the market provides. So Reese's peanut butter cup, or I think that's an airplane picture that I grabbed. So what am I trying to show here? Well, the water, what's this sign saying? You know, use it wisely. And Rothbard talks about this, that the government, when it provides services to the public, whether it's, and here, you know, we mean genuine services. We're not talking about the IRS or the Gestapo or you know, someone waterboarding you, but we mean teaching your kid how to read and write and building a road for you to drive on or delivering water or electricity to your house. These are all areas where there's either direct government provision of it, or there's private organizations that are heavily regulated, where the industry is heavily regulated. And so typically what happens is the government keeps those prices well below the market clearing level. So a classic example would be water, where in certain areas during the summer, there are water shortages. And that's what you'll see, you know, there'll be campaigns to conserve water. And they'll even be, in some places, there'll be quite draconian rationing schemes where the government will say, okay, right now, you know, there's a serious water shortage. The reservoirs are dangerously low. We expect this heat wave to continue. We don't think it's going to rain for another 2 weeks. So you can't water your lawn anymore. And if any of your neighbors, if you see any of your neighbors watering their lawn, here's this toll-free number. You call us and we're going to go punish them. And, you know, don't you, you know, then they'll tell car washers, you know, businesses that wash cars, they'll shut them all down and say, you can't use water. They'll tell golf courses, you can't water the, you know, the courses right now. And they'll tell people that try to shower every other day and don't flush your toilet unless, you know. So there's all things like, and it starts out voluntary, but then depending on how severe the shortage is, they can actually start imposing penalties. And like I say, in some cities, they actually establish hotlines so people can snitch on each other, that you know, your neighbors can act as spies for the government and report citizens who are not doing what they need to for the public interest. So that's, and that just seems normal to most people. And there's like, well, yeah, I mean, there's only so much water, and there's a heat wave, man. But of course, that never happens with the private sector. And so, I mean, that's, I'm just showing, I mean, that, like, the ad campaign for this Rhesus thing, if you're not familiar with it, there's a, that was one of their slogans, was say, there's no wrong way to eat a Rhesus. Right, so the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup Company, where I don't know where their parent company is, probably Mars or something, they're not running around telling the public, conserve Reese's. No, they're saying, eat it however you want. The example that I used is the difference between water, which is largely provided by the government in a city during the summer, versus beer, right? People have 4th of July parties and they drink a lot of beer, and it's not like you ever might run out of Heineken or Sam Adams or Budweiser in the middle of the summer because, oh my gosh, it's, you know, there's not enough beer being produced and people are so thirsty they're drinking a lot. No, you never run out of beer, ever, in terms of like a citywide level. That never happens. And moreover, you know, because there's the water shortage, the government lays out all of these rules governing the appropriate use of it. And so if you, if they see someone who's filling up a bucket of water and dumping it on his car, he could get in trouble. You know, at the very least, they're going to shame him and tell the neighbors, you should be, you know, wag your finger at this guy because he's using water to wash his car when, you know, we really need to save that for drinking purposes. But if some Budweiser executive driving down the street and he saw a guy taking, you know, a keg of beer and dumping it on his car, he wouldn't slam the brakes and roll down the window. What are you doing wasting that beer? He'd say, oh my gosh, go get some girls in bikinis and stand behind that guy and we're going to start taking a picture of this and make it into a commercial. This guy loves our beer so much, he's dumping it on his car. This is awesome. Yeah, everybody, go get a keg of our beer and dump it on your car, just like this guy. Woohoo! Have a party. You see what I'm trying to get at here? That the people who provide goods and services through the private sector, they love it when people waste their products. All right? And so, and you might say, well, yeah, that's the crazy profit motive causing people to do things that are not in the public interest. But the point is, everything is in the, you know, resources are being used efficiently. That if that's how someone wants, if that's how the consumer wants to do, he is being charged the appropriate price. So it's up to him. If the guy wants to dump beer on his car, go ahead. Or there's a, you know, another snack product. I forget what it is now. If it's a cookie or something, saying, eat all you want, we'll make more. Maybe it's Doritos. I can't remember. Right. Whereas the government does not say with its product, drink all you want, we'll make more. Right. So now part of this, in fairness, somebody like an apologist for the government who hears me giving this lecture might be rolling his eyes saying, oh, give me a break. There's a huge difference here. You know, we can make an indefinite amount of Reese's peanut butter cups or Doritos, but there's only so much water that we can deliver per unit period of time. But I would say no, there are some logistical differences, but I think it's mostly the difference due to government versus private sector provision. That if you had the private sector completely supplying water, then I don't think you would run into this. You know, the amount of water delivered to certain cities and so forth during the hot summer months would go up a lot. And in any event, if you had market pricing, whatever the supply is, the market price would ration it. So you still wouldn't, you would never, under any circumstances, need to have public shaming campaigns. The way, what would happen is, if even with market provision, they just, you know, there was a heat wave and they had big reservoirs and stuff and they had ways of pumping in water from neighboring regions, but just a bunch of things happened all at the same time and, you know, maybe there were riots or something, and so outsiders couldn't bust in lots of bottled water and things like that. Or maybe, you know, saboteurs were, it's a war zone, and saboteurs are blowing up the pipelines, and so the private utility company can't pump the water the way it normally does. Well, even there, if water is extremely scarce all of a sudden, there wouldn't be public campaigns telling people, don't water your lawn and don't wash your car. What would happen is the market price of water would skyrocket. So maybe it would cost $30 a gallon. And so now all of a sudden, if water for the next few weeks at least is $30 a gallon, you're not going to go wash your car. If you had a deal of water that made you individually want to go do that, you wouldn't wash your car. You'd go sell the water for $30 a gallon, and you'd wait 2 weeks and let your car get dirty. And then once water prices came down, then you'd wash your car. It's deeper water. Okay, so again, there's a two-pronged argument I'm making. I'm saying on the first hand, the very fact that there is this tremendous localized scarcity that hits certain areas quite predictably year after year, that would not happen if there were market provision. Because with market provision, at any given time, regardless of the momentary stocks and demand for water, the price would clear the market. And so anybody could consume as much as he wanted for whatever purpose if he were willing to pay the price. That would naturally lead people to conserve. And then because of the possibility of those tremendous profits, or that tremendously high price, I should say, the producers would set themselves up so that they could rush in and take advantage of it. So if it were the case that all of a sudden in California and in Texas and other places in certain summer months, the market price of water, given the current distribution apparatus, occasionally would hit $15 a gallon, well then right now those companies are going to be laying pipelines and getting backup procedures in place to cater to that need. But then of course that means the market price isn't going to go up so high because those areas are going to have a much better distribution system than what the government's giving them right now. Another example here, this lower left thing, is government subways. I mean, it's just, if you've never lived in a major city and seen this firsthand, you really cannot believe, and so this, I saw this when I lived in New York City, that at certain hours of the day, you, and at certain subway stops, like the subways were literally inaccessible for a certain type of person. So for me, I'm a little bit claustrophobic, meaning I don't like to be pushed and squeezed against other people. It's not like I go insane, but I'd prefer not to have to do that, especially if it's hot. And so there were certain things where I would just, you know, if I got off work at 5, I would just know I was going to go read a book for an hour before I even tried to go home. Or what I would do is I would get on the subway and go the wrong way. I would go, you know, further away from where I lived, being squished, because then, you know, the subway would quickly dissipate, and then I could get a seat and then ride it back towards where I had to go, because then it would really fill up but if you were sitting down. So there's a certain culture, and you can see it in this picture on the subways, where you, if you're sitting down, nobody's going to come and sit in your lap. But if you're standing, you can see you get absolutely crushed. So what happens is people on the platform try to squeeze in as much as they can until physically no one else can fit in there. But like I say, inside the car, in the car, there is a certain social norm that if you're sitting down, it's not like somebody is going to sit on your lap or is going to stand up on your shoulders or something. You know what I mean? Even though technically, looking at this picture, you can see there's some more volume of that subway that could be filled up with human beings above the heads of the people who are sitting down. Or the people sitting down could stand up on the seats and you could squeeze in a bunch more people, but that's not the convention. So where am I going with this? Well, look at the picture over here. Even if it's a very popular route, or another example would be a movie theater, even if it's a sold-out show, it's the opening night of a blockbuster, the movie theater regulates the traffic so that once you get into the theater and get in your seat, you're not crowded. It's not like you're squished into the whole movie, you've got some guy right in your face. Whereas with the subway that the government provides, that does happen. That you can be riding the subway and the whole ride can be awful. So why does that happen? I'm saying it's because two things. So again, riding the subway is they're not charging enough, that the quantity demanded is far too high relative to the available supply of subway interior volume at those peak hours. So they really ought to be charging people more to ride home from areas right, you know, in downtown at 5 o'clock. That should be more expensive than it is elsewhere. And they do have congestion pricing in certain areas, but they don't do it enough. It should be more pronounced. But then more generally, the whole system should be different, where they regulate how many people can get on the car. And that way it would make the ride more attractive. And you say, oh, but if they regulated it, then there'd be even a bigger shortage, right? Which is why they should build more cars, or they should build more lines, right? That's a terrible system they have, where day in and day out, predictably, people are miserable like that for perhaps an hour or longer, depending on how big their commute is. So that's, you know, that's the kind of argument Rockford's making here. And again, this isn't just some fluke. It's not just, you know, you can go through. The pattern is when the government provides a service, it's ironic. There's two things that happen. One is the actual total expense per unit quality delivered is much higher than it would be if the private sector delivered it, because the government wastes money and it has little incentive to find the best suppliers and to minimize costs, because it's, you know, they're getting their money from the taxpayer, so what do they care? But also, once the product is available, they sell it too cheaply, right? So it's a double whammy, that you as a taxpayer have to pay more for stuff that the government provides than you would if the private sector provided it. But then you don't even get the benefit of having it be quite, you know, how do I put it, of having everyone else keep their mitts off of it and for you to enjoy it leisurely, because then when the government brings this overpriced thing to market, it actually underprices it. So the things are simultaneously too expensive and underpriced, even though that sounds paradoxical. I hope you get what I'm talking about. All right, well, we got a lot of materials, let's move on. But that's actually a very crucial point. Make sure you get that among its other flaws, under typical government provision of goods and services, they don't charge enough. Another classic example would be traffic congestion on the roads. The traffic jams are not just some feature of automobile driving. No, the reason you have traffic jams is that the government is not charging enough. A traffic jam is a shortage. And you have to be specific about what's the actual good. It's something like the ability to travel on the road at a decent speed without fear of getting into an accident. But once you define whatever that good is, and you look at the existing road infrastructure, and you look at the traffic patterns and what drivers want to do, you can see at certain times of day there is a shortage. The quantity of road driving capabilities, or whatever you want to call it, exceeds the available quantity. And so if the roads were all of a sudden privatized, what would happen is, for example, the toll to cross a bridge in New York during rush hour, that price would go way up, at least in the short run. And that would ration it. And so, yes, it would be more expensive to drive from Long Island to downtown Manhattan at 4:45 on a Tuesday afternoon, well, actually vice versa, because you want to be leaving the city, to drive from Long Island to Manhattan at 7:30 in the morning when everyone's trying to go to work. It would be a lot more expensive to do it if the roads and the bridges and the tunnels were all privately owned. That's true. If they were privatized, I'm saying like tomorrow. So the day after total privatization, the tolls would be a lot higher. It would be a lot more expensive to do, to make that trip. But you would get to work an hour earlier. You wouldn't have to wait in bumper-to-bumper traffic. It would be a nice, smooth ride. You wouldn't be able to believe it. You would have a lot less stress because you wouldn't be sitting in line forever. Very productive workers would all of a sudden have an extra 2 hours per day for the rest of their lives in which to work or spend time with their family or whatever. And because of those huge short-term profits, a lot more roads would be built or better designs would be engineered such that they could move more cars into and out of the city in the same period of time. So the prices would actually come down. So in the long run, what would happen, I believe, is that you would have much smoother traffic and at lower prices than what people are paying right now. But the point is, with the existing infrastructure, the government is actually not charging enough at those peak hours, and that's why you have traffic jams. Okay, running government like a business. So similar sorts of points here. Rothbard just goes through saying that a lot of times reformers say that everyone can see that the waste and inefficiency in government operations or government enterprises. And so people will say, oh, well, you know, we just need to bring in some, you know, CEO from the private sector and have him run this thing like a business. And that's the way to do it. And that's why you often see, especially for on the Republican side, candidates who were successful in the private sector, and a lot of voters think, well, this guy's going to go to Washington and clean things up because he knows how to balance a budget. You know, he knows how to fire people if they're not pulling their weight, and and this guy knows efficiency, and it never works. And why is that? And again, it's not Rothbard's point in these sections here is to say this isn't just a coincidence. There is a systematic economic reason that these government practices or enterprises have these predictable outcomes. So why can't you just run government like a business? Because there's a couple key differences. So one thing is, depending on what operation you're talking about, they might not get their funding voluntarily from the alleged beneficiaries of the service or recipient or customer. So like the police force, if they go arrest a killer, it's not like they're getting paid by the people who otherwise would have been victims. Right, so clearly, you know, unless you're a pacifist, you think there should be some organization or multiple organizations that are out catching bad guys, like actual criminals. Even, of course, Rothbard doesn't like the government doing that, but he thinks there should be private agencies doing it. But the point is, who pays them? And the way the government runs the police force, the citizens who benefit from police protection, they're not directly charged in a voluntary contract. No, they're taxed, and then out of that general pot, the mayor and whatever, you know, however the legislative process works, gives some of that, gives the police department a budget. And then they get those funds and then decide, okay, let's go to try to crack down on murderers, but also we want to stop bank robbers, and also we got to stop people from speeding, and they have to decide how to allocate those resources. So that's complete, you know, that's like mini socialism right there. how do they know how to do that? Should they spend more money hiring homicide detectives because there's a serial killer? Or should they crack down more, you know, hire more beat cops to walk the streets and stop petty vandalism? You know, someone's spray painting graffiti on an overpass. Do you want to have more cops out in the streets stopping that kind of thing? Or just to have police walking around, will that sort of, you know, make residents feel safer and maybe keep the criminals a little bit more at bay? You know, those kind of sorts of questions, that they're in the police chief and the mayor and so on, they're in the position of a socialist central planner. They have no way of rationally using those resources because their customers are not paying them directly and voluntarily for the enjoyment of those services. So they really, even if the police chief and the mayor are angels, we're not saying they're, even if they're not corrupt, you just assume they're genuinely trying to do the best thing they can for the citizens, they have no way of knowing if they're doing a good job. And so Roberts says, you know, even if it's better or it's not as bad, the closer we get to a genuinely private company. So these examples here. So this on the left is Amtrak, which is, it's not, I forget its exact legal status. It's not a branch of the government, right? It's not like the tanks owned by the Defense Department. Amtrak, I don't know if it's a private corporation. It might not be. But the point is, but it does, if it gets into trouble, if it's running a deficit, it can get support from the government. The post office is a similar type of story, where technically, my understanding is the post office is not a branch of the government. It's a separate entity, and technically, I think it doesn't directly receive tax dollars in the sense, I don't think there's a part of the budget that's for the post office the way there's a part of the budget for the IRS or other agencies of the government, the EPA and what have you. I don't think there's a budget for the post office. I think it's supposed to rely on the receipts it gets from its business operation, you know, people buying stamps and mailing stuff, packages and whatever. But still, if the post office is running a deficit, it gets low interest rate loans from the government. And so so Robert's point there is that is still government support. And also with a lot of these alleged government business partnerships that are supposed to be run like a private sector operation, a lot of them, even if once they're up and running, are left to sink or swim on their own merits, if they were started with a generous upfront infusion of government money, well, then it's still not a private sector business. And so we still can't look at, you know, so let's say the government takes $10 million and sets up, I don't know, some high-rise apartment in a certain blighted neighborhood, and then, but then says, okay, but you know, we don't want to have the taxpayers be on the hook, so you rent this out now to the residents in this area and go ahead and make money, and they, you know, then they just give it to some local real estate developer, or maybe more plausible, there's a developer, that, you know, a sports team's thinking about coming into a town. But they want a new stadium that's going to cost $50 million, and the private developers are only willing to put up $30 million. And so then the politicians run the numbers, and they say, oh, wow, well, you know, if we had that major league sports team come and locate in our city, we'd get lots of more tourism, and tax base would go up, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, we'll kick in the other $20 million from the taxpayers in order to make this thing happen. So after it happens, you might look at that and say, oh, well, that's run on market principles. You know, the sports team is bringing in a certain amount of revenue from the ad, you know, they play and it's televised and they sell the TV ad space to private companies, and this is all, the fans come and pay their tickets at the door. So this is, hey, this is the market, man. This is free market. No, because that $20 million came from the taxpayer. And that would not, that thing would not exist had that not happened. And so we can't say that that's an efficient use of resources. Yeah, after the stadium is built, perhaps the most efficient thing is to do what's now being done, but there still was a misallocation of resources, and we're still poorer than we otherwise would have been had the government not spent the money that way, and instead just lowered taxes by $20 million that year. Along those lines, Rothbard takes on the notion of so-called public ownership. And this is a picture of Central Park, in case you don't know what that is. So it's a large park in Manhattan that is considered to be publicly owned, right? So average residents of New York City would think that, oh yeah, we all own Central Park. That's our heritage. And if you said, hey, why doesn't the city government sell Central Park to the highest bidder? And maybe we'll put up a shopping mall or something. Wouldn't that be awesome? I mean, probably most New Yorkers would be horrified if you said that to them. But, and they would probably, if you asked them why, they'd probably say, well, that's ours. We don't want to give that up. But Robert's point here is, in what sense does the public actually own these sorts of assets? They don't really. Really, it's the government that owns them. And he says, if you doubt that, then try, I'm paraphrasing, I forget the exact way he put it, but let's say it's Central Park, try going and setting up a tent, and then when the police come and kick you out, you say, well, I own, I'm one of 8 million residents, so I own 1/8 millionth of this park, so I'm just not sure where is my share. Just tell me, and I'll be happy to move my tent over there, because, I don't want to be camping on somebody else's property, but apparently I own part of this park, so where do I go to set up camp on my land? And of course, they're going to look like you're crazy. Look at you like you're crazy. And then he could say, and so Rothbard then deals, he says, well, someone might say, oh, but by the same token, you can own 1/10 millionth of Ford Motor Company. And, if it's a publicly traded company, you can own a few shares of stock, and you wouldn't be able to go to a factory and say, hey, which set of tools is mine, because I own 1/1,000,000th of the company. And Rothbard says, okay, but there, yeah, it's true, so you and a bunch of other people collectively own all the assets of Ford Motor Company, but you're allowed to sell that. You can sell your shares of stock to somebody else, but you can't do that with Central Park. You can't say, I understand I own 1/8 millionth of it, you know what, I don't want it. I never use the park, so I'll sell that to somebody else. Like, some guy who lives in New Jersey, maybe he wants it. So can I sell my own partial ownership to that guy? You can't do that. All right, so Rothbard's saying that really it's metaphorical when we say the public owns these things. Really, the government is the legal owner. In terms of what does ownership actually mean, it means you can sell it, typically, and that you are the ultimate decision maker regarding how it's used. So the government, under those definitions or criteria, is the actual owner, not the public. Before I talk about Social Security, let me just mention something regarding this whole issue of government ownership of assets. Rothbard makes a profound point, and this is one that Hans Hoppe picks up in his book on democracy, that under democratic government, where there are elections, periodic elections, and there are government officials who are in charge of the government machine, but they know they're only going to be there for a few years before some other coalition comes in, that sort of arrangement actually perversely gives the government officials at any moment, the people who happen to be in power at that time, gives them incentive to basically strip mine all of the so-called public assets to just, you know, to suck all the value out of them as quickly as possible, even if that is a very inefficient extraction method. And so it's ironic because a lot of interventionists will defend government ownership or milder forms of government interference with the free market, saying the private business people are very short-sighted, whereas the government takes a long-term view. You know, so, oh, you wouldn't want to, like, if it comes to a non-renewable resource, let's say. So the classic example used to be oil, but now since of the issue of climate change, actually this doesn't sound right because now the government's trying to get people to not use oil. But back, you know, in 1930, if you asked the interventionist about oil, back before they thought there was any issue of burning and releasing carbon emissions in the atmosphere and warming the planet and so on, back then if you had asked an interventionist, a big government type of person, should we just have the extraction and burning of oil, should we just leave that to market forces? They might say, no, that would be silly because the business person, you know, only looks out a few years maybe. And so they're just going to say, well, here's the market price right now for oil and here's my extraction cost. And if I can bring oil to the surface, if I can pump oil out of this well, then it costs me $10 a barrel. And the market price of oil right now is $12 a barrel. Well, heck, that's a good deal. I'm going to do it as much as I can. Not realizing that, oh, we're going to run out of oil in 24 years if we keep doing it at this rate, so we better slow down. So we need to have the government step in and take a long-term view. You know, that's the idea. But it's the exact opposite. In reality, the owner of a resource in the market, a private owner, of a resource over which he exercises total control, seeks to maximize the present discounted value of the revenue accruing from using it, selling its services, and from its spot market value at any given time, its capitalized value. So if you're someone and you're sitting on 1 million barrels of oil, right, you've discovered in your backyard there's this big deposit of oil, and it's about 1 million barrels just sitting there, and you're trying to decide how quickly do I want to pump it to the surface and sell it to others, if you're thinking through the logic of it, the smart thing to do, the optimal thing to do, is for you to estimate what you think the world price of oil is going to be going into the future. And then you have to decide, and you also have to forecast what interest rates are going to be. And then it's just an optimization problem of saying, well, if I sell more barrels today, you know, I'll get the current market price, but then that leaves me with fewer barrels down the road. And so if it's obvious to everybody that at some point we're going to run out of oil, well, the market price of oil then is going to be really high. So people today aren't going to sell every last barrel of oil because they know the market price is going to be twice as high next year. So they would save some of it. They'd hold it back, hold it off the market. All right, so I don't have time to go through the whole logic of it, but that's the idea. And so if you make a few, you can do it, you know, mathematical economists can do this formally and make a bunch of simplifying assumptions, and you get show that it has to do with the spot price of oil rises over time with the interest rate, and then you have oil is extracted at the optimal rate over time. So the free market, the decentralized decision-making process in a competitive equilibrium ends up extracting and burning oil at just the same rate that a benevolent central planner would do, you know, if you thought around and thought, what should a central planner do with a non-renewable resource? All right, because no matter what, whether you have socialism or capitalism, obviously there's only a fixed amount of oil. And it'd be stupid to say, oh, well, we don't want to ever use it because then the future won't be able to use it. Well, if you never use it, then when your kids grow up, they're going to make the same decision. They're saying, well, we don't want to use it because then our kids won't be able to use it, and so nobody ever uses it. Well, that's dumb. But at the same time, it might not be right for our generation to use up all the oil because then our kids don't have any oil. So when you think through the trade-offs and you know how would you even frame the problem and answer the question of what is the optimal, what is the economically efficient rate of consuming a non-renewable resource like oil or natural gas or coal or whatever, that we have reason to think that actually the free market would tend to achieve that. So obviously some of this stuff is not a totally Austrian thing. I'm just trying to fill in the holes for you there. Whereas in contrast, and so now I'm coming back to the point that Rothbard and Hoppe explicitly make, government officials don't have those incentives. Right? If you're a government official, it's not the case. Sorry, one last thing. So what you're doing there, the reason that happens is because you as a private sector owner, you're not merely looking at how much revenue am I getting right now for selling off barrels of oil. Because every barrel of oil you sell, that lowers the market price of your well, of the deposit, the land in which your oil is sitting. If you're pumping at a higher rate, well, then the value of that asset is falling faster than if you pumped at a lower rate. And so there's a trade-off there, and you can so that's what you're trying to tweak in order to maximize the value of your estate, of all your assets. But you've got money flowing in the door because you're selling off barrels of oil, but at any given time you also could, if you wanted to, sell your whole parcel of land for a big lump sum. So, and the other thing too that's neat is, even if you're going to die before you run out of oil, you're still going to have the incentive to make the right decision. Because all you have to assume is that you want to maximize the value of the estate that you hand on to your heirs. So you're not going to do something that brings in $1,000 more per year but makes your land lose value at $1,300 per year more, right? That would be silly. So yeah, you would have more cash to give to your kids because you sold more oil, but then the land you handed over to them would be worth less. And if the numbers work out such that you can give them a bigger total combination of assets if you pumped fewer barrels per day, well then that's what you would do if your goal is to maximize the market value of what you hand over to your kids. Okay, so it's not even that people, that business people are short-sighted by a few years or say, oh, okay, well, I can see them looking out to their death. No, they want to maximize the value of the asset, in which case, you know, it can bootstrap, and in principle, you could be looking out centuries, in a sense, okay? With government officials, again, it's the exact opposite, because if you're a government official, and you're in charge of leasing a federal land on which there's oil, what are you going to do? Well, and so now here again, we get into trouble because actually the outside consulting work I do, we're trying to get the government to see the advantages of allowing more development of oil because they have, you know, political constituencies that don't want development. But let's say there weren't issues about environmentalism and stuff like that, and you're just a government official with this pool of oil that's sitting on federal land, and you're trying to, you know, you're taking bids from outside companies to lease the land and to develop the oil, your incentive there is to give as big a favor to these outside companies as possible so that when you're out of office, you know, they reward you. They give you a nice plush consulting job or whatever. Or maybe even while you're in office, you know, they throw lavish parties. And I mean, we don't have time to get into it, but some of the stuff that private companies were doing with the Bureau of Land Management a few years ago, like they got caught, like they would bring in escorts and cocaine and stuff like that and have wild parties for these guys that work for the government and who were in charge of, like, giving these people permission to develop, you know, the natural gas and oil and stuff like that that was on federal property. So, anyway, it's kind of scandalous. But so your incentives are not to maximize the combination of the receipt of money from selling off the oil and the land value itself, because that's the government's. Now, you can't, if it were discovered that some government bureaucrat literally tried to sell off a portion of the federal land to somebody in the private sector and then to pocket the money, that person would get fired. He'd probably go to jail, right? Because you can't do that. That's corruption. That's embezzlement. That's stealing the public's property. But it's perfectly acceptable for him to allow an outside company to pay money into the treasury for the right to have, you know, to bring his equipment onto federal land and drill a hole in the ground and start pumping the oil out and then taking it and selling it and keeping the money himself. That's perfectly acceptable. That's not corruption. That's, you know, bidding off the right to drill on public land. So the point is the government officials in charge of that process don't have any incentive to maintain the asset value of the land, because even though we say, oh, the government owns that land, actually there's no human being who owns the land. There's various humans who cycle in and out of the positions of authority for short periods of time. So technically the government as an institution owns that property, but the government is not really a thinking agent. It's the individuals who take over, you know, the reins of power temporarily. So you get this perverse thing where, again, the policies are enacted to just suck as much of as much money out of the government assets as you can very quickly while you're in office. And you don't care if that's actually inefficient. So what I mean by inefficient is, just for example, just physically speaking, in terms of the geology or the engineering, the physics behind it, if you have oil deposits, there's a way that you can, how can I put it? It's possible that extracting it at too high of a rate, too quickly, can make the thing like collapse underground. So you end up not getting as much total oil out of it over the lifetime of the well, compared to if you had been more careful and, you know, maybe drilled more access wells and I don't remember the exact details. But the point is, if your goal is to get as many barrels out of this deposit in the next 18 months as we physically can, then you'll do it a certain way and you'll get a certain, you know, maybe you'll get 1 million barrels and that's it. And then the well will run dry, literally. But if you were willing to be more patient, maybe you could extract 2 million barrels, but it would take you 8 years. And so if interest rates are low, clearly the second thing makes more sense, assuming that, you know, your other extraction costs aren't much higher because you get twice as much product. And assuming, you know, the world price of oil doesn't collapse after the first 18 months. Okay, but if you're in office for 2 years, and, you know, you're a congressperson and there's some scandal and you know you're not going to run for re-election, then if you're in charge of how the oil is extracted, you might opt for the first alternative to get those million barrels quickly, not because you're pocketing the money, you're not. You're allowing some private oil company to get them, and you're not even charging them that much. They're not paying that much to the treasury for the right to do that. All right, so that's the thing. So when it really, the best thing in terms of, you know, what to do with with federal property would be just to privatize everything, right? That, you know, the what they call the first best or the optimal thing to do would be to take that land and just sell it off to people in the private sector. Now, even there, that comes up with issues too, because there's no reason to suspect that the auction process would be done properly. And also, we get into moral issues too about why should the government get any money in the first place, right? So don't quote me on that. And other Austrians might disagree. I'm just trying to get you to see, even if we have valuable resources like oil in the ground, it gets real complicated as to how do you best integrate that into the structure of production, because if you have the government serving as a roadblock there, it's always going to get screwed up because they actually can't be run like a business. All right, I need to move on. Social Security. Thing to remember about Social Security is that it's neither social nor secure. One point is to say it's not really insurance. A lot of times, at least in the United States, they refer to this as social insurance programs. That's kind of how they used to talk about it a long time ago. But it's not insurance. It's not that you're paying a premium in case something happens to you, because it's rather a Ponzi scheme. The money is not invested, right? So with actual insurance, you know, the money comes in, and then it's enough to either fund it if it's an event that's supposed to happen that time period, and if not, if it's something that might happen down the road, well, then those premiums are invested into assets that build up over time, so that then when the thing happens in the future, you get paid. And the same thing with private retirement plans, typically at least, that the way those work is while you're in your working years, you take aside, you know, a chunk of your income, whether your employer does it automatically or you do it on your own, and then you go invest it. And so you have this big growing stockpile of wealth. And then when you retire and you're no longer drawing an income for your labor, you start living off of this big pile of savings. But that's not at all how government-administered Social Security works. When you, during your working years, take a chunk out of your paycheck that goes to the government for your Social Security tax or payroll tax, it's not like the government goes out and invests that money on your behalf to start growing this pool of assets so that when you hit 65 or whatever it is, they start drawing down those assets to pay for to send you checks every month. No, the money that comes out of your paycheck for so-called Social Security, the government spends it that year. You know, it just goes into the general fund and they spend it on whatever. And so the trust fund, what happens, you know, there's supposed to be, at least in the United States, there's this dedicated payroll tax. And so the idea is people want Social Security to be self-sufficient. That it's not that we just have a general tax on everybody and then we pay people according to how much they made and whether they're widows, that kind of stuff. Rather, we, in addition to your income tax and sales taxes and property taxes and all the other taxes we have in this country, you have your Social Security tax. And there's part levied on the employee and part levied on the employer. There's also Medicare. So the idea is that is supposed to be self-sufficient, that the money taken from the workers just for Social Security, and then every year how much is dispersed to recipients through the Social Security Administration, you want those numbers to balance over the long term. And so what happened is it was in deficit, and then in the early 80s, under a committee that actually was chaired by Alan Greenspan, ironically, they jacked up the Social Security tax. And so what happened is, and that was implemented under Ronald Reagan too, you know, the low tax Ronald Reagan. So what happened is workers from the early 80s onward were kicking in a lot more year after year into the Social Security Administration than the government was dispersing year after year at that point to recipients of Social Security benefits. So there was a surplus, right? Social Security looked at it as a separate entity, you know, segregating it from the rest of the federal budget. Social Security was running a surplus year after year because it was taking more in receipts than it was paying out. So the Social Security Administration is sitting on right now a trust fund, and it's, I forget how big it is. It's, I don't even want to say, it's over $1 trillion. I don't want to say a number because I'll embarrass myself if I'm not close. But what that is, and so people say, and now since this recession, the last, I think it was 2 years ago this happened, Social Security actually was in the red, meaning, well, you got to be precise, actually. What happened, I think it was 2 years ago, was when it started. Because of the severe recession, so a lot of people aren't working, and some people are, you know, have retired earlier than they otherwise would have. So Social Security's incoming payments went down, and its outgoing, or it, the incoming contributions went down, and the outgoing payments, you know, that it pays recipients, went up. And so it actually, that number flipped. So it was what you might call cash flow negative. You got to be careful. It wasn't technically in the red, at least it wasn't when this first happened, because it was earning enough from its assets that technically, you know, the interest off of its IOUs that it held plus the incoming tax payments was more than the outgoing benefit checks. Because I debated some guy in Social Security, he, you know, zinged me on that little technicality. So just be careful to say it was in the red. Technically it wasn't in the red. But you get the point, that the tax payments by the workers was smaller than the checks being written to beneficiaries that year. So people, that keeps happening, and it will continue to happen as long as this recession lasts. And at some point, even if we're back to a normal economy, just with the demographic shifts, that's going to perpetually happen, given the current tax rate and the rules governing when you can retire and what kind of check you can draw and so forth. So people, that's what people in the United States are worried about. Oh my gosh, the solvency of Social Security, it's going to go broke. And so the defenders say, oh, we got time, don't worry. There's trillions of dollars in the trust fund. And that's the reason the trust fund was developed. That's why in the early 80s, when we jacked up the rate and workers were kicking in a lot more than Social Security was paying out, that's why we did this, to build up that nice cushion, because we knew this demographic shift was coming. So the demographic shift, in case you don't know what I'm talking about, is that the American society is getting older. And this is happening throughout Europe, too, and lots of places, except, you know, like in the Asian countries, it's not happening necessarily. So the idea is that for every worker, the number of retired people who are drawing Social Security benefits is getting bigger as the decades pass. And so the ability of Social Security to keep this game going is shrinking. It's gonna blow up at some point. So anyway, the defenders of the thing say, you know, we've got a lot of time to act, don't worry, we have this huge cushion, this trust fund. But it's a little bit weird. It's not like they're sitting on a bunch of diamonds. What the trust fund is a bunch of pieces of paper from the federal government saying, I owe you whatever, $1 million. And they have several trillion dollars worth of those things, pieces of paper. So the way I like to explain to people is to say, to show you just how useless the trust fund is in terms of making us worry less about Social Security, suppose there's some new intern working for the Social Security Administration, and she makes a mistake and she accidentally dumps the trust fund in the shredder. And now, you know, what was a bunch of bonds issued by Uncle Sam now gets shredded. And oh my gosh, I just destroyed, you know, all these trillions in assets that the Social Security Administration held. Does that mean now all of our retirees are you know, going to starve to death because I just made this mistake. Well, no. It's true. Now the Social Security Administration's assets just went down by X trillion dollars. But by the same token, Timothy Geithner is going to say, whoa, the federal debt just went down by X trillion dollars. This is sweet. We can go borrow X trillion more from the public and we'll be in the same position we were in yesterday. So long as the federal government were willing to lend that money to make a one-shot transfer to the Social Security Administration, things would be just how they were. But I think sometimes when I say that, people, it clicks and they get it and they see the issue of the trust fund. That it is, you should not be relieved that, oh yeah, Social Security right now is not taking in as much as it's paying out, but at least they're sitting on the trust fund when the trust fund is just a bunch of pieces of paper from the Treasury saying we owe you this money out of future tax revenue. So if you think about it like that, that's no, you know, if the trust fund disappeared, we'd be in basically the same situation in terms of the voters and what they want the federal government to do and regarding federal spending, including Social Security benefits. Okay, socialism. Rothbard mentions that the typical left-right spectrum in which communism is considered on the far, far left and fascism is considered on the far right, you might say that, you know, people might argue that Joseph Stalin is the polar opposite of Adolf Hitler, because Joseph Stalin is extreme left-wing and Adolf Hitler is extreme right-wing. And then you have more moderate people in the middle. So, you know, Stalin is far left, Barack Obama is left, but not nearly as much, and Ronald Reagan is to the right of Obama, but Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini, they're way to the right of Reagan, because they're, you know, Reagan's kind of a fascist, but come on, he's not nearly as fascist as Mussolini and Hitler. That's the typical way a lot of Americans, at least, I don't know how you guys do it in Europe, analyze the political spectrum. But of course, that's crazy. That's not useful at all. From Rothbard's point of view, the true distinction between political ideologies is freedom and individual liberty and respect for property rights on one end, and more government ownership culminating in absolute totalitarianism on the other. So in that sort of spectrum, Hitler and Stalin are two variants of the same thing. And where, you know, whereas anarcho-capitalism, Murray Rothbard would be on the other end of the spectrum. And just to drive home that point, I tell people this a lot and they are surprised that Nazi stands for National Socialism. And yet, so it's funny, a lot of people believe, and the reason is because, like in the Spanish Civil War, you had the communists fighting the fascists. And so it's understandable why people think that communism and fascism are these deadly foes, but extreme fascism is socialism, as is communism. Rothbard also points out that when we look at the historical record and try to see the relative success of capitalism versus socialism, that actually is giving too much credit to the socialists, because in practice, and I don't know if Rothbard knew this at the time when he was writing this, but we actually do have confirmation of, so, you know, people who lived under socialism at high levels of authority said that they would rely on market prices generated abroad when they're drawing up their plans. All right, so the point is, as bad and as inefficient and as much of a calculational chaos as the real-world socialist governments exhibited for us, they were, you know, they had cheat sheets from their neighboring capitalist countries. And that if you had true worldwide central planning with no market prices anywhere in capital goods, then you would really see just how much socialism would deliver complete calculational chaos. Driving home that point, Rothbard says that one way to think about, in terms of his interventions, one way to think about socialism is that it tells workers what they can and can't do. And that, he points out, that's bad enough in terms of a static system, but it's really bad when you realize that under capitalism, there's constant innovations. People come up with new technologies, and even things that aren't so sexy. You know, so obviously, when Apple unrolls some new product, that's, oh, wow, that's great. And we can all appreciate that sort of innovation. But even something much simpler, like my favorite example, this kind of thing, the way you board a flight. That before, I can remember when the standard practice was they would just announce the rows. So if you were in row one, you went on first. If you were row two, you went in second, row three. And you think about it, that's crazy. That's a stupid way to board a plane in terms of minimizing the time it takes to get everyone in the, you know, outside airport lounge into the airplane with their bags stowed and sitting down with their seatbelts on. And so various airlines come up with different ways to do it. So that one, Delta does it by boarding by group number. And so they always let first class get on because that's what those people are paying for. But then once they're boarding the general seating areas, they hit the people that are in the back first and the people that are like on the windows. And so you start, you know, you want to send a volley of people walking to the back of the plane so they can get to be sitting down and taking time putting their bags overhead and whatever. And then you want to send a volley of people maybe in the middle of the plane because you don't want to have a big bottleneck up front. You know, you don't want to have the people up front on the aisles sitting down first because then the people who have to sit in the window have to wait for them to stand up and then you get the point. So just little things like that, little innovations, people seeing the way business works, making a slight little tweak to do it better, more efficiently. That sort of thing happens under capitalism all the time, day in and day out. But under socialism, it wouldn't. If you literally had top-down central planning and there was no black market and people really did wait to get their orders from the guy above them before they did anything. I mean, that would be just completely a complete paralysis of innovation. All right, and then the last thing I'll talk about is Rothbard goes through and eviscerates John Kenneth Galbraith, that's whose picture this is, who talked about the alleged sins of capitalism and the affluent society, which is a very popular book. A lot of different points here. So one of them is Rothbard says, isn't it ironic? It used to be, back when socialism was in vogue, that, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, what the socialist theorists promised the masses was that socialism would deliver more material progress to them than they were getting under capitalism. So that they were, you know, the theorists and reformers were promising the workers, you will get higher pay. And they were promising the poor people, you wouldn't be poor if we had socialism. It's capitalism that doesn't develop quickly enough. But by the 50s and 60s, Rothbard's pointing out, the utter failure of socialism compared to capitalism was so apparent they had to change the rhetoric. Now, the alleged sin of capitalism was that it was there was too much luxury spending going on. It was like repugnant. It was unseemly, unaesthetic, all of this blatant consumerism. So you see the irony there. It used to be capitalism was faulted for not delivering consumers enough, and then when that became, you know, completely untenable to make that charge, when we saw actual socialism in practice, it flipped to, oh, look at this, socialism just makes us all fat, or sorry, capitalism makes us fat, and, you know, we have these commercials and invents all of these desires that people think they have, so I have to go buy a car with big tail fins now, and instead of just being content with a little dinky car like the socialist government gives me. So you see how they had to flip the argument because they couldn't with a straight face keep telling people capitalism keeps you poor and socialism will make you rich, because they had examples and people could tell that the people in the socialist countries, you know, didn't have different types of clothes, that everyone wore the same type of thing, and they didn't, you know, their diet wasn't very varied, and they certainly weren't pigging out and getting overweight in North Korea. Last point I'll make here, I'm a little over time, is, and while I'm making this point, I'll start bringing up the questions. Rofford points out that a lot of people who, when they do criticize capitalism, so it's sort of contradictory. It's mostly they don't like the sorts of things that capitalism develops, but they still cling to this idea that growth is too slow under the market economy, and that it would be faster if they, you know, if the government got involved somehow, whether lightly by taxing things in a certain different way or through outright central planning. And so again, there's a little bit of a tension there, because on the one hand, how can you be criticizing capitalism for growing too slowly if you're also criticizing it for rampant consumerism and materialism and, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and all that stuff. But in any event, Rofford points out that the problem he, the detour he makes, he actually showers some criticism on free market economists and people on the so-called right wing. And he says, you know, you guys, this is partly your fault that Galbraith and these outright socialists are getting away with this charge, because you guys do seem to often champion growth for its own sake and saving and investment as if they're intrinsically good, rather than what you ought to be doing is to say the rate of capital accumulation and the savings rate and the amount of investment versus consumption production, that the optimal thing to do is to let the free market handle that. That, you know, you can't say, oh, it's always better for the economy if people save a little more and we, you know, if GDP grows more quickly because we're saving at a higher rate. Because in the limit, we should never consume anything. You know, if that's what you really believe, then you're saying you'd rather you ultimately would like to live in a society where the savings rate is 99.9%. And GDP, yeah, GDP grows at 18% a year, year after year, but you know, you're barely at a subsistence level the first year, and then the next year, instead of getting to eat, you know, a bowl of rice every meal, you get to eat a bowl of rice and a piece of celery. And then the next year you get to put a dab of mustard on it. And the next year you get to add a saltine cracker. And the next year you introduce, you know, getting to drink a can of soda once a week instead of just drinking water. You get what I'm saying? That, and meanwhile, you've got all these amazing factories that are just sprouting up all over the place because 99.9% of your income you keep plowing into investment. And everybody is a millionaire many times over. But they live like absolute paupers because they save so much. And, you know, people will die having worked hard, never going on vacation, whatever, for 60 years, and they die, and they hand over to their kids a $50 million estate. And the kids say, wow, that's great. And they just plow it in, keep rolling it over. And the kids now, because they're so rich compared to their parents, they eat a bowl of rice and an egg roll every other meal for their whole lives. Okay, I'm painting the picture, but you get the idea that why would we think, and you say, well, what are all those factories producing? They're producing rice and egg rolls, and they're producing other factories so that we can produce more rice and egg rolls into the future. You get the point that if you push it to the extreme, just working and saving and investing for its own sake would be crazy. That what would be the point of that? That ultimately, at least in terms of economics, the ultimate goal of saving and investment and capital accumulation is consumption. And if people want to make a trade-off, there's no questions for this week. I just noticed. So, okay. So if people want to defer consumption in exchange for more consumption down the road, they're free to do that, and that's all well and good. But the point is, it's not that saving and investment and capital accumulation per se are intrinsically good, at least as far as economics is concerned. So if you subscribe to the Protestant work ethic, you might say, no, according to my religious upbringing and the way I read the Bible, you know, that's what you're supposed to do, and it builds character, hard work, and you know, I would find it repugnant to just be an idle consumer, just lounging around and slurping. So being like the people, if you've seen the movie WALL-E, where the robots cleaning up, you know, the Earth gets devastated because of pollution and all that stuff, and so they build spaceships that the people have to leave Earth while WALL-E, the robot's cleaning stuff up, and then he goes to the spaceship, and then the humans, you know, this is hundreds of years in the future, the humans are absolutely disgusting. I mean, they're nice, like, you know, they mean well and everything, but they have built little chairs that zoom them around, and they just eat carbohydrates all day. And like, they have restaurants called, like, Carboland and Carbs R Us and stuff, I forget the, you know, and they just, you know, sip their thing and just sit around, and they're all extremely obese and everything. Because, of course, the makers of the movie are trying to, like, give warnings about this is where our society is headed, and you understand it. But in any event, the point is, as an Austrian economist, if that's what the market outcome is, you can't criticize that. You can criticize it according to your own personal value system, but you can't say that that's inefficient. And so anyway, just to finish that train of thought, Rothbard is chastising the so-called right-wing economists who tend to champion saving and investment and whatever, and make it sound like it's a good into itself, rather than saying the government shouldn't be interfering with people's voluntary preferences. So it probably is true that government policies lead us to save less than we otherwise would. And I think Hans Hoppe makes that argument in several places. There's various things, not least of which is you're not as sure about the security of your property going into the future, because for all you know, the government's going to change policies and seize your stuff next year. So on the margin, if you can enjoy consumption today or postpone it and save and invest in something that's going to pay off next year, you're less likely to do that if you're not sure that you're going to be able to keep it next year, because the government might take it from you, or they might, you know, pass some regulation that makes it so you can't enjoy it. So there's all those issues like that. So it probably is true in practice that government policies are keeping people worse off according to their own subjective preferences by making them, by tilting the deck or stacking the deck against saving an investment. But again, the reason that's wrong is because, or the reason it's inefficient, I should say, is that according to those people's own preferences, they would like to be able to save and invest more, and the government is artificially penalizing that outcome. Okay, well, I'll stop there. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. I will have your quiz posted. And I think this week I'm in town, so there should be office hours, but I'll have to look at my calendar and see the exact time. And just do the reading for next week, which is the last session for this class. I'll see you then.